Good afternoon. I am really happy to be here this afternoon. I'm Donna Behrens. I am with the Center for Health and Healthcare in Schools at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. And I would, looks like we're going to be kind of a small group, so I don't know whether you guys want to move up a little bit, just to keep it, okay. In the back row of chairs are some resources from our center, as well as a copy of the presentation that I'm going to be doing. Can I just find out, I think we're both interested in knowing who we have in our audience. How many of you here in the room are working in school-based healthcare or school-based mental health? How many are clinicians, administrators? Do we have people that work for state government, federal government, and teachers, school counselors, school guidance, school nursing, students themselves getting their master's in public health and really interested in the topic? Okay, great. Well, I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk to you today. I have nothing to disclose. I think I was supposed to say that. And how do I, that's how I advance it. I'm going to be talking today about overcoming stigma, about mental health, and lessons that we have learned from working with immigrant and refugee families. The learning objectives, very quickly, I hope today, and I'm speaking on behalf of colleagues from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville who worked with us on this project, we're going to be talking about how mental health professionals can inadvertently create stigma around their school-based mental health services, and to talk about some successful strategies we have for adapting and making the school mental health services less stigmatizing. So I want to just contextualize why we're even talking about this, as these are some of the stats on our changing demographics in the United States, and I'm sure many of you are very well aware of it. Our latest census told us that now we have about 10 states where we are going to have a majority of the population who will be considered minorities, and this is due in part to some of the recent waves of immigration. So, what we know about our immigrant and refugee families when they come here. We talk a lot in mental health circles and in school mental health about the traumatic events that happen both before, during, and after their migration. But there are other issues that that we found and that research supports that affect our children and their families. These include the loss of their support systems, their support networks, home, family, and friends. Many families tend to be, either if they're refugees, they're being located into, or if they're immigrants, they are winding up in areas that are low socioeconomic, high crime, and poverty. There's the stress of acculturating to a new place, and we found that with some of our communities, especially with the refugees, that there are host community hostilities and discrimination that really cause a lot of stress and emotional distress for our families. So all of this leads to, with our students, certainly academic struggles, poor peer relationships, the inability to get along, the feeling like an outsider, disruptive behaviors in schools, and just a real quick story. Oftentimes, we, especially in the refugee communities, schools, they have kids that are coming in that have never been in a formal school setting before. They don't know the rules, they don't know how they're supposed to behave, and they don't know how to deal with being teased, bullied, or how to make themselves fit in. So they tend to become a little disruptive. School attendance, when the kids start feeling very ostracized and isolated, they stop coming to school. And then at the kind of top of the issues in terms of just how it's affecting the kids, some anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. So today I'm really going to be drawing on the experience of a program called Caring Across Communities. This program was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It was a multi-site grant initiative, brought together students, educators, mental health providers, agencies, community organizations, to build emotional behavioral services for immigrant and refugee children. The Center for Health and Healthcare in Schools at George Washington University acted as the program manager for this multi-site project. It ran from 2007 until 2010. The program had 15 sites, and the criteria for original funding back in 2006-2007 was that it had to build on community partnerships, it had to utilize the school base, it had to reduce barriers to mental health care created by language and cultural differences. So again, this is a very abbreviated shortcut to what was a very long call for proposals. As part of the Caring Across Communities project, we had a program evaluation. We contracted with Dr. Clea McNeely and her team at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And we looked at three key questions. We wanted to know what were the challenges being experienced by refugee and immigrant children in schools. We wanted to know what were the essential components of comprehensive mental health services in schools for refugee and immigrant children. And we wanted to know how the partnerships could be used effectively between schools and communities in order to complement and really do a good job of offering comprehensive mental health services. What we did not evaluate, and I want to be really clear, we did not look at how effective was the services, what the students' outcomes were they offering good mental health services. We are really looking at, these were pilot projects, they are all very, very different, and we are really interested in knowing what were the components that needed to go into doing a good job of offering mental health services in schools to these specific communities. So there was no evaluation of effectiveness. Well, what we did do is we selected five sites, and without going into a lot of the detail, and I'd be glad to answer it later if you're interested, but we selected five sites that had geographic diversity. They were all different regions. They were different size cities. We had some large urban, some mid-size smaller cities. We had a diversity of parents and students who had who were either refugee or immigrant. The study, again, this was not quantitative. It was a qualitative study. We went in doing interviews. These were the types of participants and the number of people who were interviewed. The data collection was done through collecting information from 75 interviews. The site they were on-site visits. These were two team members from Knoxville who were going to the five different sites and doing one-on-one interviews with parents, family, staff members, school members, and community members. The data was analyzed, everything was recorded, transcribed, and again, for the purpose of time, I won't go into the data analysis and how it was done, and if anyone's interested, I'll be glad to answer those questions afterwards. More importantly, I'd like to talk about what we learned. I'm going to talk first about not just what the stigma, but I think to put it in the context of what we learned from all five sites. So we present kind of our learnings in two different triangles. This is the first one, which is the hierarchy of challenges. And it's in a triangle very purposely, because what we found in evaluating those five sites and interviewing family and community members is that, much like the Maslow hierarchy, unless families are very challenged around the economics, the language, and for our students, the academic challenges of entering our school system. And what we found in across the board in the five sites is that unless the programs were addressing the economic, language, and academic challenges, and then secondarily to that, the adaptation to a new culture, they really could not engage families or students in talking about behavior or talking about traumatic experiences. That this is really the underpinning to how to conceptualize the challenges that they faced, and then also then what are the components that go into what we found to be the most effective schooling comprehensive mental health services. And again, This is done in a triangle because every single site reported the same thing, and that's that in order to successfully work with the families, engagement was the first thing that needed to happen. So it wasn't a, if you build it, they will come, that there really needed to be some strategic thought to how to engage the families. And then secondarily to that, you had to address those basic needs. You had to be looking at the economics, you had to be looking at language, you had to help the families address the acculturation issues. We found over and over again, families said they couldn't think about their kids' behavior if they didn't have enough warm clothes. I mean, dealing with some places that are very cold and families that are coming from environments where they've never dealt with freezing cold weather. They weren't prepared for it. So unless you're helping these families have a safe place, food to eat, clothes for their kids, you've met their basic needs, you really can't move to the other points on this pyramid, which is supporting their adaptation to a new culture. And then the final is the emotional and behavioral supports. You really couldn't even engage them in talking and thinking about that unless you were engaged with them and helping them address their needs. So a secondary finding to what we're answering and looking at those three questions and looking at components and what the challenges were that we really found that an emerging finding was around stigma, that it wasn't what we originally came out to talk, we originally went into the evaluation to think about, but it really came out over and over again in the discussions, both with the clinicians, the program staff, the families, the communities, and parents. And that stigma was, and I want to be really clear, the stigma was around the families and students even seeking out mental health services in schools. And the stigma really acted as a barrier to them, to getting them in the door. So what kind of stigma we were seeing were the stigmas associated with the social repercussions of seeking mental health care. And we, in this culture, those of us that have been here for a while, talking about accessing mental health services is not something foreign to us. In some cultures and in some languages, they don't even have words for mental health. They have words that go along with mental illness. And it is a taboo socially and within small communities to have any mental health related issues. The other thing that came out over and over again with families is the fear that their kids would be taken away from them and institutionalized. So that was kind of what we called social stigma. And then their own personal perceptions that from their cultural point of view, that when you talked about mental health, you were talking about being crazy and it was considered very taboo. So advocacy materials, advocacy touts school-based health centers as overcoming barriers to mental health stigma. Yet, we don't find much evidence that explicitly links just placing school-based strategies as a way to reduce that stigma or that demonstrates how they function to overcome stigma. I think when you're in a school and you're serving a population that may be very diverse, you know from working with the families how to help them overcome that, but we don't really kind of address it and talk about it in the literature very much. So stigma, out of the five sites identified that were evaluated, stigma was identified as a barrier to mental health service in three of the sites. And the findings of McNeely and her group, ironically, were that these were also the sites where, from the external evaluator's point of view, were most successful in over time, and again, these were three-year, four-year grants, seeing an increase in access to services within the immigrant and refugee population. So what they found that programs were doing that could inadvertently create stigma for families and students around accessing care were using what we have as common language. Talking about psychologists, using the word mental health, was very intimidating to some of our parents. I put in here a quote from one of our, and this was from a clinician who found that when they sent the flyers home, how the translation was worded and how the families perceived it was actually a deterrent to them wanting to actually come and get services. So I think, again, these are all, you know, we make some assumptions, we put it in school, we're embedded in the community and in the school, and we put out what is our traditional kind of flyers or brochures or go talk to families, and oftentimes we're not thinking carefully or we're not finding out what is the better language to use in order not to stigmatize it. The programs that were looked at that only provided mental health services, they weren't looking at the family engagement, they weren't doing some of the outreach around some of the basic needs, they weren't providing some of the other services that families required. They only had mental health services and only labeled them as mental health services, had the most problem in terms of actually getting families and students in to utilize their services. So, again, traditional mental health terminologies were perceived by community members as labels. And I think that the idea of decontextualizing it from people's life experiences, I think using language such as, are your kids having a hard time? Are they upset? You know, using language that contextualizes it in a way that parents can understand it made it much more acceptable to think about how someone might be able to help. But just, and the other most successful terms used by the programs was talking about academic success. The one thing I think that stands clear, parents wanted their kids to have a good life. They wanted them to be educated and they wanted them to succeed in school. So anything that helped around academic success was useful in terms of changing the language. So what were the strategies? So I just said, you know, we don't have any proof that locating them at school really is a way of overcoming stigma, yet all the parents really came back and said, and community members, that putting it in school still is really important, that it enhances the ability to interact with families in a setting that is non-stigmatized and helps in gaining trust. It also allows the services to be, again, put in the context of kids' school success and academic success, rather than talking about a mental health clinic or having them visit a mental health clinic. Probably one of the most, I think one of the best features we saw in many of the programs and across all 15 sites, but specifically in the five sites we used, were the sites that used something that we're calling, and people have lots of different labels for this, but we're calling them cultural brokers. They tend to be people who are of the community, part of the community, and may have already moved through a lot of the adaptation and acculturation, yet have good ties to the community and understand the community and are trusted within their own community, who then act as a broker between the community that you're hoping to be able to serve and the service providers and the school itself. And the programs that were most successful in utilizing the cultural brokers were the ones that made those cultural brokers most accessible. And they did home visits. They were 24-hour call-in time. These were people that were showing up at weddings. They really were accessible to the community. And then they're at back-to-school night, and they're at greeting the kids as they came off the bus. So they really work on building a relationship of trust. They're really about educating staff about the community and educating the community about what mental health services are, and again, using language that contextualizes it in a way that's not stigmatizing and that has meaning to the people within their own community. They were very important liaisons, and they provided mental health care in that they could help families with some of the stresses around acculturation, getting their basic needs met, and dealing with what it is to be a parent in this culture. So we felt the cultural brokers were the key actors in reducing the stigma associated with it. This goes back to what I've been saying since I kind of started talking about the evaluation, which is that you really need to embed mental health services in a web of other services that are addressing basic needs, that are helping with the adaptation process, that are providing social and emotional support. And it could be, we had one site that offered cinema night for parents. They happened to be showing movies that related to some of the immigration experience or the refugee experience, and then afterwards would have a potluck dinner and discuss it. And it was a way of doing it that was non-threatening, yet was very significant in helping these families begin to talk or be able to talk and share some of the experiences they had. So again, not all the programs were able to provide basic needs, but that linkage back to who are the community partners, who is in the community, who is able to help with some of the basic needs and some of the cultural adaptation was really critical. And this is where the cultural broker oftentimes was the one that could help the most. So again, we found, and I'm sure you guys who are working in schools know this, challenges are interrelated, and the families did not put them in separate silos. I go here if I need food. I go here if I need help with my heat. I go here if I'm having emotional behavioral problems with my child. They just see the emotional distress that's caused by the experience they're going through as all being interrelated. And so we, again, when those programs were dealing with all of them, they were tended to be the most effective. So what we found was the parents at all three sites were able to identify and trust service providers as people who helped, not mental health workers. And we talked about this fourth strategy using non-stigmatizing language. Service providers really intentionally, very intentionally, changed their language when they described the children's emotional needs, their mental health services, and what role the providers could play. One of them, right from the onset, did not use any of that language. The other two learned after their first year that they were not getting families engaged and engaged the families to then change the language, and they altered everything and really changed the dynamic. So, quick recap, working with cultural brokers, put the services at schools, integrate it with other basic needs, and use non-stigmatizing language. So again, this is all about an ecological model for how one approaches mental health services, and cultural brokers were key actors. Considerations. We need to continue to be open to learn from and within communities, and mental health needs to constantly be thinking about how they provide it, where they provide it, and whether it is contextualized to how the community they're trying to reach. We still need to work on destigmatizing mental illness. It is still an issue. This did not deal with mental illness. This really dealt with how to access mental health services. And funding, unfortunately, is still based on having a model of diagnosis and care that is westernized and really doesn't integrate these. It's my contact information. These are the references. There is copies of my presentation in the back. I'd also like to let you know that we have a number of resources, including the full report from this evaluation on our website, many other tools, documents that grew out of the Caring Across Communities program. I'd encourage you to visit our website and contact me if you have any questions. Thank you.